think so. I think it works. Thank you, Deanna, for inviting me. In February 1983, I was a young student at McGill University in the Faculty of Education, and I had the amazing opportunity to go to Northern Quebec to do my student teaching. And I didn't know in 1983 that there were Indigenous people living in the north of our province. I had no idea. When we were told as students that we were going to go north for our student teaching, I thought they meant the Laurentians. I didn't even know I was going into the Arctic. But that's where I ended up. And just before I left, my professor said, if ever a hunter or somebody asks you to go out on the land, you have to go. And thankfully, I did get an invitation to go out on the land in March of 1983, and I jumped on it. And what I'd like to do tonight is talk a little bit about that experience through three sort of versions of it. Being a writer, I had to write down the experience in my journal, and I've never read from this. I sort of mentioned it to Andre that I was going to perhaps read sort of the aftermath of that trip. So it's rough, and this is a 22-year-old's vision of going out on the land. I'm going to read that before I read the poetry. Mark Papagatuk took me for an incredible ski-doo ride out into the landscape that surrounds Sugluk. Although the land is beautiful and the idea of man as a speck in an endless sprawl of tundra is exhilarating, my inner experience went beyond that level of beauty. It went to a dimension past that of the pure physical experience. In fact, I have to repeat that talking about it all just isn't enough. I thought I would never again experience anything as potent or as stimulating as drugs felt 2 years ago. Today I learned something very important about myself, and I'd trade anything I own just to have this feeling again. Out on the skidoo, dodging rocks and bumps and bushes, I felt that I was doing everything in life that I wanted to do. I don't mean the whole teaching thing in a foreign context and having a nice afternoon with a native. I mean that in those 3 hours, 25 miles away from Sugluk, life really touched me. And it's nothing even very complex. In fact, it's so simple that I have trouble using the right words to have it all make sense. It's nothing I'll be able to explain to anyone else because I only shared it with Mark, and probably he would be surprised to know that I learned the most important thing I've learned so far from him, not from McGill, not from mom and dad, not from any lover, but from a 17-year-old man. I learned that any life that happens with the land and with nature is the most valuable thing in my concept of the important things of life. Far beyond university and textbook knowledge, survival on the land is fulfilling and beautiful. I've always hated the word beautiful, but I learned what that word meant today. I watched Mark stalk and kill two ptarmigan birds. I watched a keen man crouch through waist-deep snow until he got within gunshot range. When the Inuit have caught their game, they pull off some feathers and stick them up in the snow. It means luck for the next time they go out. Along the way, Mark and I stopped a few times to talk and make sure we were both still warm. Or rather, Mark stopped a few times to make sure I was comfortable and warm. He even took off one of my boots so that the warmth would circulate better. White people are like little kids when they're out in the wind. He's so right. His face is a beautiful light brown with red cheeks and medium-length black hair. He wears a tweed cap on his head. Once we stopped at a 2-month-old igloo, went inside and smoked a cigarette together. I asked him what he thinks of whites and Inuit intermarrying. He's got quite a sense of humor. Not everyone's perfect, he said, referring to white men. We laughed, and I threw snow at him. When I got back from Saluit, everyone was telling me, you have to write this down, you have to write about it. And this was 1983, and there wasn't a whole lot of material out. Our people weren't, or at least white people weren't, writing a lot about it. And I just felt, when people were telling me that I should write about it, that I just didn't. I didn't want to. I felt like it would be kind of like a betrayal of the people I had gotten to know. And so I didn't write anything. For about, I think, 15 years, I didn't write anything. And then one day, I got a call from CBC Radio asking me if I had any new material. And I figured I had had enough time to let the experience sit with me. And I started writing a few poems. And they became sort of the basis for a collection that finally came out in 2002, I think, called Snow Formations. So I'm going to read sort of one poem from that, and it's kind of lifting from my journal and that excursion that I went on. I have to tell you that I was petrified when I was out in the middle of what I thought was the middle of nowhere, because once we left the land, the village, we were just out in the tundra, and I didn't recognize, I mean, there's no street signs, there's nothing there, it's just flat. And, well, it's not just flat, but for me it was just flat, and with the occasional hill. And the people who live there recognize all those landmarks, but I certainly didn't know where I was, and I thought, if something happens to this young person who took me out on the land, how am I going to get back home? And it's something that came up last couple weeks ago. I actually did go up north. I brought Andre up, who had never been up there. And I think every Canadian has to go north and see that place. It's just awesome. But we were out with a former student of mine, a student who I'd had in grade three, who I've been in touch with since. And she's in her 40s now and married. And they invited us to go out on the land. And we were 80 kilometers in the boat away from the village. And I said, how do we get back if we have to get back? And she says, you walk, you just walk along that mountain ridge all the way back. And I said, but there's bears there. She said, yep. This is called The Student. Every day the words freeze in your throat, but still you go on surprising me. Tell me, what are you scribbling there in the rough cloth pages of your book? Today the sky is a joy, plush velour, texture I can really sink my teeth into. Not like the other sky I left behind. Drab sheets of metal nailed over cities and electric pylons. It's taken time, but I'm getting used to the long, empty silences, the rugged lines, the way each day you force open my eyes a little more. Your note addressed to teacher floats into my hands, an unnerving puzzle of white space. There, buried in the deep snow, the palest of footprints. Nature doesn't fail, you wrote. People fail. 63 words for snow, and still I don't know what to call the thin, feathered kind. Tremors on the roof. From home I watch you on your sled, strapping gear. Young, bare hands like those of a man working the rough, white grain of the ice. A small wind blows up the staircase of my spine, a sign, and soon we are beyond the hills, gorging on cloud and air, billowing through voluptuous drifts of meringue. Back home, we'd have called it a date, the way you came for me in your baseball cap, cigarette jammed behind an ear. The way we made tracks on your sled like lovers on the run. The way the copper light rounded our huddled shapes, hounding us through the clapping cold. Your gun startles the snow into a soft white commotion. At the tail end of silence, the shuddering mass and its burgeoning red stain, we are all three in our own state of madness. Soon a flurry of voices in my head, urging me over impossible roads to where you are no longer boy, but hero, predator, any man who will lead me into the naked wilderness of his breast. Best not complicate a thought. Far away, you kneel in a thatch of blood, fingers in mouth, throat sucking down the livery bits of your kill. Your gun startled me, a blizzard, then nothing but the simple light and your solitary figure humbling itself to the sky. What it means to be vulnerable. Two snowflakes on this immense white planet. Riding home behind you, my body exposed like a bare nerve, your young human back dishing out warmth. 17, and already you've fathered a child. What have I ever done? Who have I loved? Civilization is homing in on us. Your finger points ahead to the dusky village, tangerine glow over a wing of snow. Time is running out. We are racing over perilous ice. The wind scrambling my hair is from hell. Tilting my head in the coarse light, the horizon is a strand of your hair, a long, mysterious stretch of darkness. I reach up to touch the end of the world. It is not so daunting. Pale light drifts over puffs of snow, tugging at the eye, the sleepy heart. Your hand travels into mine, tracing every line and curve. Even in death, there is life, you say. Listen to the way, silence fills up with silence. Listen to the dunes. They are talking to you. I'm just going to finish off with the novel version. So about, I don't know, 10 years again after the 15 years after I actually sort of away from the original journal entry, I was lucky enough to get a grant to go to the Banff Arts Center for 7 weeks. And I just sat there, and I'd had this story in my head going around about an intercultural relationship between a white Halunat woman and a local from the community, so an Inuk man. And I kind of really wanted to look at, and it's something I've always been interested in, is the idea of separate cultures, can they really come together? Is it possible? Is there ever kind of, can we bridge that gap? And I've always been interested in looking at that. And so this book really goes into that story. So Yasmin Haddad is a Syrian Canadian woman who goes up north to teach, and very idealistic, and she wants to be a good white person. And she is a feminist, and when she ends up in the north, she meets a traditional Inuk who is also very modern in many ways, and they have a relationship. And I won't spoil it for you, I won't tell you the ending, but before she meets Ioannisi, she does go on this excursion with a student that's not her student, Her colleague's students. So I'm just going to read that little bit where they're in the igloo. They've just gone hunting. They're in the igloo, and they're kind of having this little flirtatious moment. He removed his hat and shook the wet out of his bangs. She removed hers and copied him. They laughed. She noticed that his teeth were very white. With one hand, he shook out the contents of the rucksack, thermos, votive candle, foil-wrapped bannock. He lit the candle and blew out the match. She imagined she was in a prehistoric cave by the light of the very first fire. Together, they laid down the caribou hide, pinching the corners into the drafty cracks of the igloo. It occurred to her that if they died that night out in the cold in the middle of nowhere, no one would know it. It wasn't beyond the realm of possibility. They could be mauled by a polar bear or buried alive in a raging blizzard. The skidoo could break down and they could freeze to death. Anything could happen. She felt her own vulnerability, how inconsequential she was, just a speck in the scheme of things, almost invisible, like the sun, which seemed enormous to humans, but was really only one of 2 billion stars in the Milky Way. After her father told her that, she walked around the house for an entire week with a blanket over her head, pretending she was a dust mote. Adami tugged the sleeves of her parka and eased it off as the candle spread its warmth between them. He unlaced her boots and lifted her feet out. She could hardly feel them. He lowered the zip of her snow pants and gently removed them. She couldn't stop shivering despite 2 other layers of protection, a pair of blue jeans and her long underwear. He kneaded her legs with his hands, rubbing the circulation back. Didn't seem weird at all. Haluna are like kids when they go out in the snow, he said. He massaged her toes one by one. Whenever past boyfriends had tried to touch her feet, she'd squealed and kicked them away, but Adami's hands felt good on them after the extreme cold. He seemed to know exactly where to touch to bring the blood back. He moved from a kneeling position to a cross-legged one facing her. Ati, little woman, give me your hands, they're freezing. He warmed them with the heat of his own. She felt a pang of disappointment when he let them go. He unzipped his parka and fished through his pocket for cigarettes. His eyes lit up when he put his hands on them. It's been a while, he said. He struck a match on the toe of his boot. Leaning into the flame, he lit it and breathed the smoke in deeply. Yasmin gestured for a drag. Bad for you, he said. You're a teacher, you should know better. She could tell he was only half serious. Come on, just one to warm me up. Okay. He held its moistened tip against her lips with the same fingers he had dipped in the ptarmigan entrails. She closed her eyes and inhaled deeply, almost forgetting where she was. The smell of ptarmigan didn't bother her. Her only thought was of how people here survived against all odds. They killed animals and then they ate them. She imagined Adami's ancestor in caribou skins and sealskin boots wielding his harpoon to feed an entire tribe, using the tricks of light to his advantage. When she opened her eyes, she saw Adami staring at her. His eyes bore the reflection of a hunter bearing down on a creature, snapping its head back like a twig. Or maybe it was just the combination of excitement and the cigarette making her feel lightheaded. He unscrewed the thermos and poured some tea into the cap. Drink, he said. Their fingers collided. She tried to deflect the awkwardness. You think I'm funny, right? Funny I look, he said. No more smoking for you. His smile spread like a warm band of sunlight. She took a sip of the tea. After that, he came alive, telling her a story his grandfather had told him when he was small, a story about the land, the animals that inhabited it, and the hunters who stalked them. "You're an amazing shot," she said, "an incredible hunter. We don't like to brag about what we kill. One day we might not be so lucky." She listened intently. She wanted to learn everything he had to teach her. For a moment, she forgot that he was only 17. "My grandfather told me that the spirits of the dead animals could be listening too, and they could be offended, so we don't show off." He took a long puff on his cigarette. His coarse hair was especially beautiful. She resisted the urge to reach out and touch his face. Each time the desire came, she slapped it down. It gave her palpitations. She wondered if she was the sort of person who lived exotic adventures just to have a story to tell, or if maybe she was a chameleon who behaved one way around family and friends and another among strangers. By candlelight, he looked like a man. He was a man. Already he knew what the land taught and how to survive the elements. A grown woman, what did she know by comparison? Math and history and literature. What good was any of that here in this primal place where all you needed was a strong pair of hands and wherewithal? "Promise me one thing, Adamie. Promise that even when you finish school and get your diploma, you won't forget the old ways." He looked at her solemnly. She noticed a row of pimples in the indent of his chin. "You know," she said, "we aren't doing anything wrong." His lips opened a crack. He blinked and moved toward her. She felt herself working hard to remain calm. His hair smelled of snow and cigarettes. Somewhere in the deepest part of her, she wanted him to feel her with his hands. Her instinct was fighting for him. She moved closer, trying not to be obvious about it. His warm breath was blowing across her lips. Any closer and her hair would be in his mouth. She hesitated. She gave in. She pulled back again. She started to say, "You're amazing. This is amazing out here with you," but realized her talking was getting in the way. She considered letting him kiss her once, just once. Who would it hurt? At the last second, she retreated. She turned her mouth away and gave him her cheek instead. She hugged him with great affection, sweetly, the way it had to be.